thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
We never get a pass, you know, every day. Breaking big rocks into little rocks, thinking big thoughts for you. Hi, it's John Williams in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We're here weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon on social media. Look for WGN King John. That's me. On the one. The Mincing Rascals was judged by the Headliners Club to be the best podcast in Chicago. That's the one I host with Steve Bertrand, Patty Vasquez, Justin Kaufman's often in the mix, and some friends of ours from the Chicago Tribune, including Eric Zorn, the columnist, and their editorial cartoonist, Scott Stantis. We just recorded a pod about an hour ago or two, and we will post that this afternoon right after the show. Listen for the Mincing Rascals as they kick around the results of the mayoral election in Chicago. They go to Cohen Land and talk about the testimony, and there's some other things that we talked about as well. So that's the Mincing Rascals podcast, another way to kind of get into some of the things that we are doing here. You know, Jen, when you were doing traffic and you were just mentioning some of the things going on I-80 in my old stomping grounds of Minooka, reminds me that I was traveling down 55 to my folks' house in Joliet the other day, and I was reminded who the worst people are. The worst people are...
Okay.
Pause for a moment and contemplate who in society do you think regularly demonstrates behavior so reprehensible that you would stick them with that label. The worst people are...
Oh, the people who go less than the speed limit and are not passing in the left lane.
That's a horrible kind of person. Here's the one I'm thinking of today. Oh. It's the person that tailgates emergency vehicles.
Oh, yeah. Because, the ones who are jockeying for position.
Right. Like, here comes an ambulance or a fire EMT truck, and it's like, oh, my God. So everybody kind of moves over. Mm-hmm. And even that's not a given anymore. But people move over. And then on I-55, as soon as they do, Stevenson southbound, hello, boom, people pull over, and they're, like, running behind this guy, thinking he's going to clear a path. I'm going to get to Bolingbrook in no time. Don't do that.
So dangerous.
I know. Actually... I don't do that because why, John? Because the lane is open. The speed limit's 55. I'm giving him all of the distance he needs. I don't know. There seems to be something either dangerous or cheating about that, especially when you see that in the city, on city streets, where somebody's carving out a path, and at least between the lights, you get to run with that guy. You shouldn't be that guy. So that's my...
In the city, it's very dangerous because everybody moves to the side and then they expect as soon as it goes past that, you know, they zip back into the lane. And if there's somebody tailing like an ambulance, all of a sudden that's causing a crash because people are trying to get back into the lane. It's not good.
I don't that often drive, and I sure don't drive the Stevenson that often. I do a little bit. My folks live down there, so I get down there every couple weeks or so. But usually I'm on the L. But so every now and then when I am in the car driving, especially on, you know, the major thoroughfares that you report on, I am reminded how, A, people are listening to us. You are listening to us right now in your car, and you may be, you know, driving Chicago traffic, and I'm sorry for you. That is no way to live. You are spending way too much of your life. When I get to be king, we're going to do something about this. This is, we take it too for granted that the traffic that you live in and drive in that is so much a part of your life and your mood is a given. There's got to be a better way for us to do some of this.
For most of my career, I've been an a.m. drive warrior, meaning I go to work at about 4 or 5 a.m. And people are always like, how do you wake up at 3, 3:30 in the morning? And I'm like, I don't have to sit in 2 hours worth of traffic every day to go to work.
It's is like better.
12-minute straight shot.
Although, do you find this, because I was for a while driving from Wrigleyville to LaGrange to play basketball at 6 a.m. So I'd have to get on Lakeshore Drive to the Stevenson at about 5:15. And one nice thing about that is there's not a lot of traffic. But the other thing is there's such an insufficient amount of traffic that people can drive crazy.
Yeah.
So now, while you could make a 70-mile-an-hour shot down 55 out to the suburbs, some people are doing 90 and they're weaving.
Well, some people are still coming home from the night before.
I don't know if that's it or just super obnoxious behavior or somebody who's got to be somewhere at 6. I don't know who those people are, but I would say that the most dangerous hour for me driving Chicago expressways is not the rush hours. It's 4:30, 5:30 in the morning. Because there's just some nutsos out there. I do not understand those people. Do not understand them.
I always say the only two types of people I see on my way to the morning drive is police officers and drunks, but luckily I see more police officers.
I'm glad to hear that.
So
I also saw somebody who was in the, and I remember when they announced, I guess IDOT does this, they decided that you could use the buses could travel on the shoulder, the left-hand shoulder going southbound. And those aren't CTA, those aren't Metra.
It's PACE.
It's PACE, yeah. PACE buses. So there they are doing like 55 on the shoulder while you're doing maybe 12 miles an hour. And if somebody's leaning out to get a peek at what's up ahead or
that
whatever.
That scares me.
I just thought this is, there will be bad crashes. And since then, I have never heard of a crash.
Oh,
so I guess it's
knock on wood.
It's working. But then every now and then I just had all kinds of nice visuals for me the other day. There was somebody zooming down the shoulder, just taking advantage of that lane the way the buses do.
Yeah.
And I'll put them on my bad person list, too.
There's a lot of junk in the shoulder. Lots of pieces of car and glass bottle parts.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'd be scared that.
Takes your chances.
I have an update really quick on that I-80 thing that I was talking about near Ridge Road. It's a fully engulfed bus fire. It's in the right lane. It's blocking the right lane, so everything's pretty much stopped from Brisbane over to Ridge Road.
If you go by that, let me know whose school that is.
Yeah.
That would be Manuka Community High School out that way, MCHSU.
So hopefully everybody's okay. We'll do some more research. But yeah, if you're sitting in that and not driving or have a passenger that can shoot a picture over too, at Traffic Jam Jen on Twitter.
Say that one more time.
At Traffic Jam Jen. Yes, that's me on Twitter.
Shoot a picture of what you see there to her. And if you go by that and can pass along any information, we'll forward that along. Them's my old stomping grounds.
Yeah.
It's 114 on WGN. All right, Producer Aleph, let's do this. This is from Jimmy Kimmel's show. Lady Gaga is his guest. He was so funny. He introduces her this way.
In the shallow, in the shallow, in the shallow. We're far from the shallow now.
On Sunday, millions of women around the world became furious with their partners for never looking at them the way Bradley Cooper looked at our first guest during their show-stopping musical performance. She is a brand new Oscar winner for her work in the movie A Star Is Born, which returns to theaters for 1 week only starting Friday. Please say hello to Lady Gaga.
You know, it's just been incredible. I swear when we won, it was like my whole artistic journey flashed before my eyes. And I instantly saw myself sitting on my stoop of my studio apartment in New York City on the concrete with my keyboard next to me, trying to figure out how I was going to lug my keyboard again up my walk up. And, you know, it's just, it's incredible. You know, this was hard work.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And I, you know, I said it in my speech, and I'll say it again. If you work hard and you don't give up, you can do anything. And it's just...
I can tell you, I know you put a lot of work into everything you do. And that performance that you and Bradley gave, that was really one of the great performances in the history of the Oscars.
Thank you.
It was like, I mean, you know, we were watching it at home. We're like, oh my, what's going on between these two? And did you feel like, I know it caused this big controversy because... It was such an emote. You had such a connection with Bradley that instantly, and I guess this is a compliment, people started saying like, "Oh, they must be in love."
First of all, like social media, quite frankly, is the toilet of the internet.
Yes, it is.
It's just like and what it has done to pop culture is just like abysmal. And yes. People saw love, and guess what? That's what we wanted you to see.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is a love song, Shallow. The movie, A Star Is Born, it's a love story. We worked so hard. We worked all week on that performance. Bradley, who, you know, I, like, never relinquish control about a live stage performance. I mean, I've done a million of them. But, you know, he directed this film.
Right.
And he directed all of, you know, obviously the musical moments in the film. And so I was like, you know, what do you think, Bradley? And he laid it all out. I mean, everything that you saw, the way that it was shot, the way that they pushed the piano out, you saw them, you know, put the piano together
no
us
intro.
Walk up on stage, no intro, all of that was all him. And he even also was the one that was like, I think that the audience should be lit, you know, so that we're not just lit, the audience is lit. So then I called Roy Bennett, who I work with, and he does my lighting, and I'm like, we need to light the entire room
lights.
With amber lights, because Bradley wants honeycomb, and we gotta give him what he wants. And, you know, it was just great. And from a performance perspective, it was so important to both of us that we were connected the entire time. I mean, look, I've had my arms wrapped around Tony Bennett for 3 years touring the world. I mean, when you're singing love songs, that's what you want people to feel.
Are you having an affair with Tony Bennett? Be honest.
She said she wasn't. I was amazed at how much attention their moment on the piano bench got, because it's called acting. They are actors. They're at an acting awards show.
Yeah, they're wearing awards for it.
And they've been nominated for acting awards. So if they look at each other lovingly on TV, you go, holy cow, something's happening here. Yes, it's called acting.
That's exactly what I thought. And then when all this social media buzz occurred, I went,
yeah, maybe they are having an affair or whatever it is they have.
And then you and I together yesterday in our office, there's a TV, and someone was saying that Bradley Cooper's girlfriend unfollowed her right
Lady
before
Gaga.
Or after, unfollowed Lady Gaga right before or after that performance. And then that got our wheels turning more, right?
I understand how that would be threatening to your relationship, right? Say you're dating Bradley Cooper. That's tough, because every other woman in the world wants to date Bradley Cooper. It's sort of like the reverse of that song, when you're in love with a beautiful woman, it's hard. Anyway, so it's probably not easy being Bradley Cooper's girlfriend. And then Lady Gaga, who's like America's darling, is batting her eyes at him on the piano bench, and you're like, ah, yeah, I can just see her as a
well,
I don't need to follow you on Twitter.
If I were his girlfriend, I would be much more concerned about the scenes in the movie where they're actually, you know,
kissing and stuff.
And stuff, yeah, than on the stage performing a nice song.
I think that, really, I don't think any of us knows what that's like. But if you have a husband or wife who's a heartthrob and is attractive and makes movies where they're kissing and all kinds of nudity or whatever with another equally famous, beautiful person, do you go to that movie? How do you, you know, I guess you do, you know, hopefully you're secure enough in your relationship. Lord knows all Hollywood relationships are solid. So are you secure enough in your relationship that you can enjoy that? Or do you, in the back of your mind, go, you know, they really are a cute couple, and I'm just sitting here watching, and that's not so cool. But people were wondering what that was all about. And I saw that and thought that was terrific. I didn't think they were dating. It's 121. This is WGN. Steve, is it good that the testimony by Michael Cohen today is not being televised? Does America get a breather that it needs and deserves?
Well, this is before the Intelligence Committee, so presumably they're talking about things that are more classified. So
yesterday was oversight, which included Robin Kelly from the Chicago area, Raja Krishnamoorthy from Chicago, Quigley from the area. So we had a nice little footprint there on the panel yesterday, but today Cohen's continues to testify, but we don't get to see what that's all about. Before the show today, I visited with Robin Kelly, the area congresswoman, who talked to me a little bit about what happened. What was that yesterday? We'll play back part of that conversation at 1:30. A source of support and survival through the decades, Micah Mateer takes you inside her mother's bridge group. Tonight's cover story on WGN TV News at 9, 43 million is how many pillows have been sold by MyPillow over the last 13 years. 43 million. You haven't tried one yet? What are you waiting for? MyPillow's built an incredible business on the foundation of helping people sleep better. Millions of folks get the best sleep of their lives with MyPillow pillows. They've got this patented interlocking fill that holds your head, your back, your neck, your spine in that comfortable position. And once you're locked in there, you feel better. You sleep better, you do better the next day. And now they're going to give you 50% off a MyPillow 4-pack. Thank you very much. If you use the promo code WGN, call 1-800-299-9579. They throw in free shipping, which I think cannot be overstated enough or too much. too often you get a good deal online and then the shipping just kills you. They'll ship them to you for free and give you a 60-day money-back guarantee. Not the best sleep of your life, you get your money back. Call 1-800-299-9579. Use the promo code WGN or call do it online, MyPillow.com. If you check out online, MyPillow.com, type in WGN to save 50%. Speaking of money, we'll talk about this with Ray Kaplan. We're doing her at 2 o'clock, right? A little after the 2 o'clock news. But there's a story in the USA Today, today, dated yesterday. Today is February 28th, right? Today's the 28th? And then tomorrow is the 29th? No.
I'm going to go with the 1st.
Yeah, but my sister-in-law's birthday is on the 29th. So there was a conversation at our house last night about this. People who celebrate on the 29th, do they do it on the 28th or the 1st?
Well, I'm not going to get your sister a gift again this year.
You only have to once every 4 years. So here's the story. Millennials have officially racked up, over $1 trillion in debt, most of that from student loans. As of late 2018, debt among 18 to 29-year-olds, is that you, your kid, your grandkid? As of 2018, debt among 18 to 29-year-old Americans exceeded $1 trillion, the highest exposure for that group since late 2007. I'm surprised that it only goes back to 2007, but 2007 was when everybody was borrowing money like fools, so maybe that's part of the problem. It was houses, it was cars, it was everything. Nearly 70% of graduates from public and nonprofit colleges in 2015 had student loan debt, and the average amount owed was $30,100 per borrower, according to the Project on Student Debt. I'll tell you what, when I get to be king, A, we're going to get people off the roads. I don't know how. There may be a mandatory relocation program where some of you, God bless you, but you can't live here anymore because we don't have enough roads. Possibility. But the other thing I'm going to do is I'm not going to make it possible for you to borrow money going through college to get yourself in the kind of debt you do. Shame on the universities and colleges that graduate people with degrees that will not earn them $30,100 back.
So I don't like your solution, because what you're doing is you're limiting people's education.
I am.
My solution would be to burn down all the rec centers and to offer one thing for dinner and to take away the air conditioning in the dorms.
Yeah.
Maybe not the air conditioning. But that's, to me, I've had arguments about, well, discussions with university presidents who know a lot more than me and they don't agree with me, but that's not going to stop me. You know, you've toured colleges.
Yeah.
They are extravagant now.
They're competitive. It's competitive.
Competitive, what does that mean? I mean, they're each one trying to outdo the other,
yeah,
with comforts.
Well,
and the result is 70% of college students graduate now in debt.
Because
they're building $50 million rec centers, and you can have Chinese, Italian, you know, French, whatever kind of food you want to have at dinner every night. All this money is being spent to attract students, and it's the students and families who, in the end, are being gouged for it. That's my theory.
I'm not going to argue with you, because I think that makes sense.
I mean, I'd hate to tell someone that they can't get an English degree or art history degree, because
I would. Well, I think
in order to fund the coffee bar in every dorm.
Yeah, that's an interesting exchange, and I hadn't anticipated that. But I will say this: I would feel guilty if I were the University of somewhere. Somebody graduated with a degree in philosophy, and they were going to end up $50,000 in debt. You want to get a philosophy degree and pay cash? Or I would just set limits to how much you could borrow, or how much I would let you borrow if you went to my school. Go find somebody else to take your money. But I feel it's a disservice to those students and those families if people are graduating with social service degrees, $75,000, $35,000 in debt. That's inconsiderate to them. I know they're adults, or their parents are adults, and they should be able to make these decisions. But I think the universities are preying on people at the same time. Okay, so Ray Kaplan is the attorney that handles these kinds of cases. She says hi to us after 2. Robin Kelly, the congressman from the Chicago area, talks to us about the Cohen hearing yesterday. She was there. What was going on, Congresswoman? That's coming up. John Williams in the Allstate Skyline studio. So that conversation about student debt and what to do about it, some guidance for you and me after 2 o'clock. We'll also visit with a doctor over at Amida Health, an internist who's going to talk to us about the flu. What was that, one school in Arlington Heights, 15, 20% of the kids went home, 150 students with the flu the other day. Well, that was helpful, John. I know so many people, though, and it seemed to me like it was a pretty mild flu season, and yet some folks are getting whacked hard by that thing. So is this wave unusual? What steps should you take now? What steps should we have taken beforehand? We'll talk to the good doctor. That'll be in the 2 o'clock hour as well. I'm looking at a Politico story right now. The House Oversight Committee will pursue interviews with some of President Donald Trump's children and closest allies who were implicated in Michael Cohen's bombshell testimony before the panel, Chairman Elijah Cummings said Thursday. Should the new news click be, who do you trust more, the president or Michael Cohen? I don't know how that would go. I don't know how that should go. President hasn't been convicted of lying, and Cohen's going to go to jail for it, to the Congress. All you have to do is follow the transcript, Cummings told reporters. Again, he's the chair. He said, if there are names that were mentioned or records that were mentioned during the hearing of Cohen, then we want to take a look at all of that. That means Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump may be called to testify, Alan Weisselberg, the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. Cohen indicated to lawmakers on Wednesday that Trump Jr. had a role in the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress who claims that she had an affair with the president. The whole thing seemed just so unseemly to me. It just so looked like a fishing expedition, the Oversight Committee yesterday, where they were just scattershot asking things like, did Donald Trump hit his wife? And is there videotape of that from the elevator? Or is there a love child? Literally, they were probing these questions to Michael Cohen, whose truthiness is questionable at best. Although I thought he was pretty compelling and truthful yesterday, but I understand how you are, how it's reasonable to doubt him. So we talked to Robin Kelly, the 2nd District Congresswoman who represents the southeast side of Chicago, before the show. She was there on the panel yesterday, and I asked her, what is the purpose of that committee?
So it's, you know, connecting the dots of what the president knew and didn't know. It's what's happening as far as the president's compliance with different laws, campaign finance laws, and taxes, conflicts of interest, you know, what was he doing, like the $130,000 payoff, you know, that stuff occurred to try to influence, you know, elections. So this really trying to get to what is the truth of the matter.
So while it sounds a little vague, if you are the Oversight Committee, your job is to oversee the operations of the executive branch, and it doesn't have to be much more specific than that. If the president's former attorney and fixer wants to volunteer to testify before your committee, you're just seeing what he knows about the operation of the White House since Donald Trump was president.
Right.
I mean,
you know, a lot of things are partisan and things like that, even though we get along better than people really think or as it's displayed. But really, we're just doing our jobs.
I know you know this, but the Republicans would take their 5 minutes and do nothing but remind Mr. Cohen and everybody watching that he previously lied.
They're trying to protect the president, who is, I think many would agree, one of the biggest liars. Yes, he's a liar. Mr. Cohen lied, but the president lies constantly, consistently, seemingly every day.
Who do we trust more, though? I mean, at least Cohen has been convicted. He's going to go to jail. He's a proven liar. He's going to jail for lying to the Congress. Now, he's testifying before the Congress. And the Republicans say, well, shame on us if we believe you twice.
And that's the thing. He did bring some evidence that backs up his story. But that's, you know, we have to decide, you know, how much we believe. And, you know, this is information that we have, I guess, in our toolbox. And then when Mueller gives us his information, and then when Intel looks at their information, we can all, you know, we can compare notes and see. I'm sure part of him is trying to redeem himself to it, you know, and redeem himself to his family.
Well, do you believe him?
Disappointed his family and friends.
Congresswoman, do you believe him? Did you believe his testimony yesterday?
He seemed overall credible. And one of the reasons that I think that, because where he didn't know or where he didn't think President Trump had anything, like when they talked about the love child or hitting his wife or collaboration with the Russians, you know, he wasn't just constant, oh, yeah, he did that, that he said, no, I have no idea of that. I've never seen that. I don't think that's true. So he wasn't all negative about him.
Did you have any opinion about Congressman Meadows standing, an African-American who is an ally of the president, in the room to sort of watch the proceeding by him?
Well, interestingly enough, I did not realize until I went back to my office that the woman stood up, because where my seat was, I was looking forward,
yeah,
and I never saw her stand up. I didn't realize that happened until my chief of staff said, yeah, when she stood up. Yeah, it did look, again, dramatic, theatrical, and how I interpreted what my colleague was saying was that just because someone of color works for you, that doesn't mean that you're not prejudiced or racist. Not that she necessarily was calling him that. I mean, I'm friends with Rep. Meadows also. He's one of the people I bring Garrett's popcorn to. And but I didn't realize she stood up, and I think she had some words today. I mean, I think that was unnecessary.
You didn't think it was necessary for her to say that while you might not be a racist, that is a racist act to stand a black person up like that?
Did he stand her up, or did she just feel... I don't know. I haven't talked to him.
I don't either. But
stand up on her own.
Right.
And, but, I mean, I haven't talked to him about it. I hope he didn't tell her to stand up. That would be very disappointing.
But you were disappointed in the congresswoman from Minnesota's even calling this issue out. You didn't think that was necessary.
Oh, from Michigan. Maybe she could have phrased it in another way. And I didn't think that she was trying to say he was racist. I just think she was trying to make the point that,
yeah,
you know, just because you have someone, you know, black or a person of color working for you, that doesn't mean you're not a racist. You just happen to have, you know, someone black working for you.
The chair of the committee, I feel so, the anguish on his face, the refereeing he's had to do with,
mm-hmm,
with the pain that he sometimes has expressed physically and, mm-hmm, verbally. Pat him on the back for us, because
I've told him this a zillion times. He has the patience of Job. I mean, I don't know. You know, when I first came in, it was he and former Congressman Issa, who I take high blood pressure pills from being on that committee, and that guy. I mean, it was this constant negative, no badgering. I mean, I don't know how Rep. Cummings has done his job, but he's done a masterful job, and he's very compassionate, really, really cares, a smart man, I mean, I just think he's done a wonderful job.
One last thing, Congresswoman Robin Kelly. Your colleague in Illinois, Raja Krishnamurthy, at one point asked Mr. Cohen if he knew of any other crimes the president committed.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about broad oversight. But again, that's what we're talking about. This is the job of the committee. And and as I recall, he said yes. I don't know that I heard him much more specifically than that, but I noticed that soundbite's being replayed. Do you know what Raj was up to there and what else Michael Cohen was talking about?
I don't know what Raj was up to, but and I believe Cohen said yes, but I don't think he gave us anything specific, but it gave the impression or inference that there's more to come, and maybe it's from his interviews with Special Counsel Mueller. I know they also, the other thing they keep talking about is all, you know, they said this a lot of times yesterday, all you want to do is impeach, all you want to do, and really, you know, that's not true. It depends what we find out, I guess, but I'm not sure.
Okay, Robin, nice to talk to you. I really appreciate your time.
Nice to talk to you.
I know you're busy over there, but thank you for joining us today.
Take care.
Robin Kelly, the 2nd District Congressman from Chicago, woman who was talking a little bit about the testimony yesterday. You know, the story today, since what's going on is going on behind closed doors, continues to be about Representative Mark Meadows, who had an African-American woman stand up behind him who had worked, I believe, for the president and was an ally. And she was said the congresswoman from Michigan that we were talking about is a prop. And then the congresswoman from Michigan said, you know, it was a very fine hair I thought she was splitting. She said, no, I'm not calling you a racist. I'm just saying that's a racist act when you do that. And I'm not even sure the appropriateness of that charge. They're all in the same room. I guess they get to have observations and they get to say what they want to say. But the whole thing sort of so devolved away from what's even their vaguely stated purpose, which is oversight. And now they're all squabbling on national TV about whether or not Mark Meadows is a racist or not a racist, but doing racist things. So where does the story go? Well, then the next day, they dig up video from Mark Meadows on the campaign trail years ago when Barack Obama was president. And he said something like, we need to send this guy back to Kenya where he came from. And he was criticized for that and then later said, I shouldn't have said that, but the video is out there, dude. And you'll have to answer for that as long as somebody wants to ask you about it. So here he is again now, defending his non-racist beliefs with the old video and now this new stunt that he pulls. And you've got to ask yourself, what are you people doing? How much are we paying you for this? It's 1:48. We appreciate the Congresswoman coming on. This is WGN. Lots of texts to the show this afternoon about student loan debt and what you're doing about it. Ray Kaplan, the student loan debt attorney, after 2 o'clock answers your questions. Tell your family, tell your friends. This texter says, I so agree with Steve Bertrand. Every point. Wow, Steve, how about them apples? That's from 630. It's too easy to get money, says Sheila in Aurora. Actually, Sheila, I think you're mistaken. That was my point. Steve said that universities and colleges are promising too much. They're making the whole experience too luxurious. Jessica, you're on WGN. What can I do for you? You're on the air.
Oh, I didn't plan to be on the air. I just wanted to say regarding the testimony yesterday that it seemed to me that there were some Congress people who were very rude and loud and were in a position where they held the upper hand and couldn't, they were just delighting in that. They could see him twisting in the wind. Oh, somebody more professional and has more money than I do. Ooh, I got him now. That's all. I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. I suppose if the shoe were on the other foot, Democrats would be outraged. But the Republicans were outraged yesterday that they had to sit there and take answers from a guy who had previously lied to them. What's the old saying? Shame on me if you fool me once. No. Now Bush got
fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on John Williams.
Didn't George Bush try and call that up one time at a speech?
I don't know.
It's like they say, and then he started, if you fool me the second time, then it's on you. But if I got fooled by me the first time, then if you didn't know... He just went. It was very funny, and it's why I'm not running for president this year, because I know I'd misquote famous speeches, and then I'd be the laughingstock of the interwebs. But I'm sure that if the shoe were on the other foot, if the person with 2 feet had a shoe, and the shoe didn't fit, so then he went and got another shoe, the Democrats would be equally outraged at bringing a person to testify before them who had previously lied to them if it was a Democrat that they were worried about. Let's see. There was one other thing I was going to mention here. Oh, yeah. So, remember yesterday? I'm sure you do. Steve, you picked a bad day not to be here. Yesterday, we had the author of the article from the Chicago Tribune who sampled 71 different hamburgers last month.
You did a live post or something. Yeah. I saw that on Instagram.
Instagram. Yeah, we were going to put it on Facebook. We didn't. So if you were looking for it, we did live stream it on Instagram yesterday. And the first place from Donkey Stick and Table, or some of those words in some order, that's the name of a place.
Mm-hmm.
You go to get hamburgers there. And then the Loyalist has a burger called the Loyalist. And that was the number 2 in the Chicago Tribune Food Critics Review. So the first and second place burgers were here. I was underwhelmed by both of them. I'm looking at the pictures of them online today, and I think what happened was, you know, if you cook a burger in Roscoe Village and then put it in a vehicle and drive it over here. By the time he gets here, it's not the same burger you would have had at the restaurant.
Not at all.
So I just don't think that's fair to them. But I just want to say congrats to both of them and thank you to both of them for being so generous as to serve us some hamburgers.
They were very tasty.
So you got free burgers and you're complaining about them? Is that what?
I was just trying to be honest, Steve. Right. I work for the listeners.
What do you want, 10 years and $33,000 million? You want to be Bryce Harper? Is that what you're after? You want to be treated like Bryce Harper? It's being reported now that he's signing with the Phillies.
Ah! Brenda said to me this morning, hey, whatever happened to Bryce Harper? I thought, you know, maybe the White Sox will pull one out of their hat.
ESPN is reporting it this afternoon.
What's he going to get?
I don't have the details. I'm just watching the retweets go by 10,000 at a minute.
He'll probably get $300 million for 10 years. That was the kind of, that's the going rate. That's the going rate for a good hitter these days.
Well, that's what I was asking for.
$300 million. Remember, most people will make about $50,000 a year. If you do that for 40 years, you'll make $2 million. If someone gets $300 million, then that would be what, say, most people would get. What's 4 into 300 million? That much, it would represent the wealth of the lifetime earnings of that many people for someone who won't be worth that for the 10 years that they're going to get paid that. And I know, well, then why don't you just go hit 300 and you'll get the money too? That's not the point. The thing is skewed. It's cuckoo. It's nutso.
Well, not to be the...
Yes, you're about to be.
Plebiscite or whatever it would be, the...
Mincing rascal?
Or the surf or whatever.
Right.
You were talking about college costs earlier. It's the same damn thing. It's why families aren't going to baseball games. Everything, you know, it's
why I'm not having children. I'm not lying.
Because you don't want to pay for their college costs?
Oh, no, because I have student loans. So if I had that extra income every month to feed another mouth, it would be beneficial.
You got to make choices. Mm-hmm. And I think you were asked, or we're all asked, to make those lifelong decisions at a point where we're just trying to decide if we want to be a psychology major.
Oh, yeah. At 17 years old, I don't think any 17-year-old really, really knows what they want to do
with
their life.
Okay, so by my calculations, then, Bryce Harper is going to get paid the lifetime equivalent of 75 people. He will get 75 lifetime earnings for doing his very best for 10 years.
The number I'm seeing, and again, this isn't official yet, but it's coming from ESPN sources, MLB insiders, is about $330 million.
Well, then it's even more. But you see my point? I'm not saying that he's making what 75 people would make in a year. I'm saying he's going to get for 10 years what 75 people would make in their lifetimes. I guess I've made that point pretty well now. It's 1:58. Okay, we'll pause. Steve Bertrand will have the stories that matter from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And then we'll visit with Ray Kaplan, this student bankruptcy debt attorney.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
So that'll be good.
Here's John Williams.
This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline studio. We've been talking about this afternoon. Now we're going to get you some information and some answers, unlike other shows. Here we go. Now we're in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here weekdays till 3, Saturdays 10 to noon. Social media, WGN King John this afternoon at 5. Make sure you download the Mincing Rascals podcast, judged by the Headliners Club to be the best podcast in the city of Chicago, featuring Steve Bertrand and pretty late Patty Vasquez. Justin Kaufman's in the mix a lot, too. We talked about the mayoral election and what happened yesterday, what might happen going forward. We talked about the Cohen testimony and more. So that's all called the Mincing Rascals podcast. And I want you to listen for that. In our studio is Ray Kaplan. Ray, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
You're the principal at Kaplan Law.
Correct.
You specialize in what?
Student loan law and private debt solution, settlements, and bankruptcy law as well.
I'm going to reach over here because we had some conversation before you came into the studio, and a lot of listeners were commenting to us about student loan debt. The USA Today had a story that said that millennials 18 to 29 now have $1 trillion in debt. $1 trillion in that small group, 18 to 29-year-olds.
Right.
And almost all of it is student loan debt.
Right.
And that in 2015... 70%, and I presume those are the numbers most recently that they have, they said in 2017, tell me if this sounds true, no, 2015, 70% of those graduating from college, private or public, had student loan debt. 70% did. And
that's absolutely correct.
And that the average debt they carried was $30,000. Does that sound about right?
That sounds about right, although what I see is generally higher than $30,000.
People that will come to you because they need to restructure or find a way to pay down debt they can't.
Exactly.
Give me an example of somebody that comes to you.
Well, we have students who usually are carrying anywhere between $50,000 and $80,000 in federal loans and then usually another $20,000 or $30,000 in private loans. And we generally can really get those federal loan payments down substantially. There are such good options out there that people just don't know about. And I don't know if the servicers are just not informing them on purpose, but they
well, wait
don't
a minute.
Know about
why
them.
Why would the servicer, the person who loaned them the money, tell them how they can pay less?
Exactly.
They want to get all the money, right?
Right. Their objective is to get paid as quickly as possible, to get the federal loans paid off as quickly as possible. But under the statute, they really are entitled to pay 10 to 15% of their gross disposable earnings, which usually works out to a much, much lower payment.
Is that for everybody or just people who have federal loans?
For federal loans.
So do you recommend people borrowing money for college start with a federal loan?
Absolutely. I tell all my clients that with kids, when it comes to time for their children to borrow, to try to stick as much as possible to federal loans and not private.
Is anybody eligible for federal loans, or if you make too much money, are you not?
Well, there is. That's interesting. There is a way to fill out that FAFSA form to make sure that you get the maximum amount that you're entitled to, because if the Department of Ed sees that the contribution from your family is above a certain number, then you only qualify for, you qualify for less. So there's a way to fill that form out to make sure that you get the maximum amount. And the reason you want to do that is because there's so much flexibility in the statute and how to repay those loans. We have clients who are paying 50% of the balance and then getting the rest forgiven, plus all the interest.
Go back a step. 10%? Of your income, what was that formula?
The formula usually for an income-driven plan would be 10 to 15% of your gross disposable earnings. That's supposed to be your monthly payment. So again, that's 10 to 15% of your gross disposable earnings.
After?
So, well, it's a calculation that they use that's based
mortgage,
on...
mortgage, car payment?
No, they don't take that into consideration. It's just a family of your size in the state in which you reside, and they take your gross earnings, and then they use that a particular calculation to come up with that number. But it really is generally a very comfortable payment.
So that means, because a lot of people, that number would be about what they owe on their student loan. But you're saying no, but then you would only pay 10% of that on your student loan.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then is that the setup where if you make that loan payment consistently, eventually it's forgiven?
Exactly. Right. And that's whether you're in the public sector or private sector. So if you work in the private sector, you're still going to likely get forgiveness of a good chunk of your loan. It's just that you have to pay in longer, but they set it up so that if you work in the public sector, so any 501c3 or not-for-profit, you only have to pay in for 120 months.
Nobody needs to hear me fulminating again about how I just think it's wrong that college costs that much and that families find themselves in these positions. I will die feeling that, and hopefully not soon. But there they are. Is there any news on this front, by the way?
Well, there is something especially I thought would be interested for Illinois listeners. If you know anybody who went to a Corinthian College or Illinois Design Technology Institute.
Everest.
So those
these
schools,
are private schools, trade
these
schools?
These are private schools and trade schools where a lot of people got federal loans. And under a section of the statute called the Borrower Defense to Repayment, because some of those schools violated Illinois law and other statutes, we can get the entire balance of the loan forgiven, provided that so they have to meet certain requirements. But in many cases, the entire balance is forgiven. So on one section of the statute, if you don't have the ability to benefit from the degree that you got because either the school closed down or the program you were in shut down or your credits were non-transferable, then many times the Department of Education will completely wipe out that loan balance. So, for example, we have one right now where we were able to wipe out $45,000 for federal loans on that basis.
Ray Kaplan's in our studio from Kaplan Law. The other story I saw today, again, I think it was USA Today, and it was a story where they just told the they said, here's an example. A woman graduated with $85,000 in debt. She was making $45,000 a year. And there was a firm online that she found that they said, if you pay us $50 a month, we will for a few years will lower the payment and reduce the debt. But it sounds like that's something I don't have to hire somebody to do, that I could do on my own. Or do you know much about that?
I don't know much about that. Are you talking about she had federal loans or private?
I don't know.
Okay. It doesn't sound familiar at all for federal loans. Or federal loans, the nice thing about them is that everything is delineated in the statute that governs federal loans. With private loans, it's a little bit more of a sticky situation because you're governed by the contract.
How do most people borrow money for college? Do they go federal loans, or are they borrowing from private institutions?
Most of the people that I see borrow federal funding, federal loans, but we do see occasionally people with private loans, and that's usually because they incorrectly filled out the FAFSA form, and so then they're stuck, or their school kind of herds them towards a private lender, and then that's a more difficult situation. But even then, we can usually work out a deal where they pay 50% of the balance in a structured settlement. So even that's not a lost cause.
When people do any of these things, are they declaring bankruptcy?
No. No, these are all non-bankruptcy solutions. So this is just a student loan law area.
Does bankruptcy forgive student debt?
In most cases, no. Although we did recently have a particular case where we were able to get rid of a lot of medical school private loans, because under the statute, the loans have to be considered educational loans. But if you didn't use that money for educational purposes, let's say you got a loan from Navient or some lender, and then you use the money for a vacation or to buy a car, something non-tuition related, we actually were able to get those loans discharged in a bankruptcy. Yeah. So occasionally they are.
Yeah. When we're talking about, let's do this. It's 2:15 on WGN. Normally when you come in, we get a lot of calls and texts. If you've got a question or comment or an observation about all of this, maybe Ray can help. I'm thoroughly dismayed when this topic comes up, and I'm always encouraged by the service that you're able to render. So 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Ray Kaplan is in our studio, and if you've got a question or comment, this is the time to call. We're talking about student loan debt. The story in the USA Today today said that the student loan debt now for those 19 to 28 years old, that subset of millennials, is $1 trillion. $1 trillion in credit debt, almost all of it student loan debt. And that the average student graduating from college, that is 70% of the people that leave college, have student debt. And the average student debt that they carry is $30,000 a year. Ray Kaplan deals with these kinds of cases for a living. What's the website for you guys, by the way?
It's www.financialrelief.com.
You don't have to say the WWW part. People know that, right?
Yeah, you're right.
It's 2019.
Right. I'm just old school.
It's just financialrelief.com. Literally, have you ever done this? If you go to a browser, you don't type the W's, it knows.
I know, but in my brain, the W's are there. So,
what are you, an attorney?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very precise.
John, so the texts include these. John, it's too easy to get money to go to college. 224 says student loans is the new slavery. But I hope you didn't pay a lot for that student loan because your grammar's bad. But that's me being mean because I think student loans are out of hand. John, why don't we make schools provide a statement of total cost like credit cards and bank loans have to, that would say this is what you will pay if you graduate from this university?
They actually do that.
Do they?
Mm-hmm. They do. They do kind of an entrance counseling and then an exit counseling for student loans, and they do go over all of that stuff. I think that really it's just pretty dry material, and it's the last thing people are really interested in.
630, John, make universities co-sign on these loans so they have some skin in the game regarding offering marketable degrees. Maybe have them cover loan payments until they find the art history student a job. Well, that's a good idea, but that ain't never going to happen,
is
it?
Never going to happen.
Never going to happen. John, my son owes $82,000 for a business degree, 3 years at Northern Illinois University, 1 year at NAU. Makes me sick to think about it. What do you say to that person?
Well, what I say is that if they're federal loans, not to lose too much sleep over it, because in most cases, your payment is going to be the equivalent of a cell phone bill payment every month. In most cases, I do have some clients, you know, who are doctors and their payments are a little bit higher. But in most cases, we can get the payments under the statute to be very, very manageable. And most of it's going to be forgiven anyway, so not to lose too much sleep. I think people tend to get a little bit too depressed about this. And when they realize that they actually have some clarity and control over the situation, you feel a lot better.
I'm glad to hear that, Ray. But there's people out there that are making car payment size student loan payments every month.
Right.
And not everybody has this relief available to them, do they?
Yes, pretty much everybody.
Really?
Yes.
You think that all of the people that are making gigantic $350 a month payments on $75,000 student loans are overpaying?
Well, maybe not at $350 a month.
I don't know. What are the numbers? I mean, I'm just throwing those out.
Most of the time we see clients who come in, they have payments around $500, $600, $800 a month. And usually we can get those payments down to $200, $300 a month,
really?
Which makes a big difference. Oh, yeah.
Okay, Elif says all the phone lines are busy. Huh, seems like we've struck a nerve. Let's take some phone calls,
sure.
She says. Okay, so we'll start with John. John, you're on WGN Radio. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you, John? You're on the air.
Well, I just wanted to ask, how long is a judgment live? A judgment that's filed against you, how many years does it take for that to go away, and how long can they collect on it?
I believe in Illinois it's 7 years. If I'm not mistaken, are you talking about a private loan lender or a federal? Because
yes.
A private lender.
Yes.
Yeah, and then there are certain things that can be done for them to revive the judgment. But in general, that's as long as they have to collect on it.
Okay, so if you get a collection notice after that, do you have to pay it, or what do you have to do?
You know, it really depends. It depends on whether or not they violated the statute of frauds or the statute of limitations. But you probably should contact an attorney that deals with debt collection so they can see whether or not you have a defense. And so you might not have to repay it at all. Another thing is that they may have violated the FDCPA or some other statute that would make that debt not collectible.
John, good luck to you. I'm going to go from you now to Harvey. You're on WGN. Harvey, how can we help you? You're on the air.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. Talk to me, man. What's up?
Okay. My son graduated from law school many years ago, and he had about $100,000 in student loans. Some were federal and some were private. He's paid about 17, 18 years. Would any of them be eligible for getting discharged?
For getting discharged in a bankruptcy, or you're talking about maybe getting forgiven under the federal statute?
Forgiveness.
Yeah, right. Yes, most likely. Does he still have, you said he still owes about $80,000 or so?
No, he owes probably about 50.
Around $50,000. Yes. So we would want to take a look and see what kind of payment plan he's eligible for under the statute, and it's likely that he would get his payment lowered and the balance forgiven. So I understand he's already paid a lot in, and there's not much we can do about that. But in terms of what we can do about the $50,000 now, he probably has some really good options.
He's paying about $700 a month or $600 a month.
And he's been doing that for 17 years?
Yes.
Yeah, we likely could get that payment down.
Good luck to you, my friend. Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you.
Yeah. Financialrelief.com?
Yes.
Somebody just said, what does your guest charge to review a person's student loan options?
Our student loan consultation fee is $100. And it's, I really do think it's worth it. I realize I have an incentive to say that, but it's not even an hourly rate. It's we cover everything really thoroughly and give you all your options. So,
Dana, you're on WGN. What can we do for you?
Oh, my God. Okay, my son has $250,000 in loans from pharmacy school.
Oof. That's...
So he pays like a not a car payment, a mortgage payment every month, $2,300 a month. And he's been paying for 2 years, and the principal hasn't even moved.
That's right. And those are federal loans?
Yes.
I'm sure we can get that payment down for him because I'm sure his income is good, but that sounds like it's a lot more than 10 to 15% of his gross disposable earnings. And then his payment would be decreased even if he has children or any other dependents. And I think that sounds like one of those cases where we could get the payment down by 50%.
Can you ballpark me his income? Do you know generally how much he earns,
Dana? $120,000.
Right. So, I mean, we're talking 10 to 15% of his gross disposable earnings. So likely we could get his payment down 50% or more. Maybe his payment should be right around $800 or $900 a month or so.
Instead of $2,300.
Right.
And then as the parents, like, we had to take out a lot also because when you're in undergrad, they don't give the kids that much. So we had to take it all out. So I have about $150,000 from two kids, you know?
Well, all of the same payment plans under the statute also apply to you and people with Parent Plus loans. Yours is a little bit higher if you have Parent Plus loans, and that'll be a 20% of your gross disposable earnings, but still, it's still going to be a very low payment. The main thing is to make sure that you're in the right payment plan.
So your family's $400,000 on the line for college educations. Is that right, Dana?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Good luck to you, Dana. I really appreciate your call, and I wish you the best. My heart breaks for some of these people. Mary Ann, you're on WGN. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, John. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. What can I do for you?
I, too, have a boatload of Parent Plus loans. And I'm wondering, after paying for so many years, I originally started out with about $128,000, and I'm now at $65,000. And my monthly payment is still killing me at $678.
Do you know?
I tried to renegotiate with the Department of Education, and my husband is very soon going. They did a consolidation on a number of the loans, and it consolidated out to like 8% interest. So my payment went from $1,100 to $678.
Okay.
And I am retired, and my husband is on the edge of retiring.
What's your annual income? What's your annual income?
It's about $75,000 now with just him.
Hold on. What do you have to say?
Do you also have an income?
Just Social Security and a small pension.
So here's the thing. You actually are eligible for $0 monthly repayment.
Huh?
Yes. Because your Social Security and retirement income are not the type of income that, as per the statute, that you're required to have them base the payment on. So because that's your income, now you don't want them to take into consideration your husband's income, and there's a way to apply for that too, where they only take into consideration your income. Your income is Social Security, which means that you likely are eligible for a $0 monthly repayment until the balance is forgiven. And that's exactly the type of thing that people don't know about, John. That's actually very interesting. It's right there in the statute.
I know, and this ticks me off too. I don't know why I keep inviting you back, because I get agitated at the world. I mean, if that's the statute, that means that our lawmakers have decided that this is a remedy that you should be able to have. But if you
right.
don't know it or how to do it, or it's too complicated, or they don't pick up the phone, then I think then they might as well not have written the law.
Exactly.
Okay. I've got to go, but did you get the website on that? Do you know who to?
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to go look, and then I'm going to give them a call and figure this out, because it's really high.
It is.
Absolutely.
Good luck to you, Marianne. Thanks for the phone call. Ray, we're out of time.
Okay.
So financialrelief.com?
Yes.
Wait, I know your phone number. Wait, do I? Because I created a mnemonic device to remember Ray Kaplan's
phone
number.
Oh, come on, Steve.
I'm just amazed. You just saved that woman. That was like a magic trick right there.
Oh, my God. How about the lady with the $250,000 in debt? Okay, but now what Ray's phone number? I need to think of Dick Butkus driving a car around the metro. Because if he were doing that, he'd be on the Tri-State Tollway, and that's 294.
Right.
And his number was 51. So was his number 51?
Ditka is who you're thinking of.
Yeah, Mike Ditka.
89.
Oh, 89. 89.
Butkus was 51.
Yeah, but Ditka. Oh, I got the wrong football player.
Right.
Okay, so if I think of who's driving around town? Butkus or Ditka?
Ditka
is driving around town. Then I think 294, and it's 8989 behind the wheel. 294, 8989. But now I got to remember is it 888 or 708 or
312.
312. Oh, in Chicago. That's
exactly.
Right. He's in Chicago. No, he's 312. 294-8989. Thank you, Ray Kaplan, financialrelief.com. Come back again, and let's help more people out.
I would love to.
Steve, a text has just poured in from my brother who's listening to us. He's in from out of town. It's a one-word text. It says, communist. And I'm not exactly sure what I said to inspire that. It was a text sent to us about 38 minutes ago. So we're talking about
costs of college.
Oh, that's maybe what it was. I was saying that I think it's ridiculous that people get themselves into this kind of debt and that the schools and universities should be held.
That was an eye-opening exchange you had there.
What was that?
With your guest and with...
Oh, my gosh, the reactions from the listeners.
And think of that woman who she could figure... Oh, she's been making these monthly payments and she doesn't have to make anything at all.
Because of the woman that was on Social Security?
Yeah.
I know, and I'm sorry, like, to be honest with you, I'm not even sure I agree with all of the debt reduction policies that are out there. I think you should pay. I don't think we should let you get into that much debt, but I think if you incur debt, that's an honest transaction, and you are obligated to pay it. But the government and we have decided as a society that actually there are circumstances under which you should not, or that the debt should be structured in a way that's reasonable for you. Here's the point. If you don't know that, understand that, or can't figure that out, if they aren't passing that along, then it's pointless. It's a shame how much debt people carry and how many people don't know, right, Steve? How to reduce that.
Just the numbers of the amount of some of those loans that were discussed, and then the idea that there could be ways to get to reduce it and not know about it.
70,000, 80,000, 150,000. Oh my God. And that was the one, and then 150,000 for the others.
Mm-hmm. In my experience, I feel that it has been harder to get a cell phone than it was to get my master's loans.
Yes, yes.
I remember, like, one day I was like, I applied for my master's program for the fall, and they called me. This was in January. They're like, we still have spots in the spring. Do you want to come? And I was like, yeah, why not? I'll get this on the road sooner. I'll get it started sooner. And I had those loans secured probably by the end of the day. Like, didn't even realize what it was, you know. What was all happening?
What you were getting into.
Yeah,
I think it's hard enough to know at 18, 17 years old what you're going to major in, let alone will you be able to service this debt down the road? How does a teenager know that? You know, and then they're signing up for these programs. And I don't mean to be an apologist for people that sign on the dotted line. I think there needs to be accountability. But these numbers are too big. This is just cuckoo. And, you know, if it was a one-off, if it was just a couple of silly people, that'd be one thing. But it's endemic, and I think something needs to be done about it.
It's larger than credit card debt, right?
Well, let's see. We said $1 trillion for $1 trillion. $1 trillion is now the 19 to 28 or 18 to 29-year-old, those millennial student debt. I bet they don't have that much credit card debt. Although somebody said, what about when you go to college, the credit card applications that come in, too?
Oh, yeah.
They're happy to get the meter running.
I think that has changed a little bit.
Has it?
Yeah. I mean,
your kids didn't get a bunch of them?
I'm trying to remember if they got a bunch of them, but we actually had a hard time getting a credit card for Emma, and I had to get help.
No kidding.
From my good friends at Wintrust to do it.
They enticed my sister with a burrito the first
really?
Day of college. Like, here, if you sign up for this credit card, you get a burrito from Chipotle. And
that's why Kevin has 37 credit cards now.
It must be.
Wait, I get a burrito for what? What do I got to do? I don't want to make
Is
fun of
here?
You there, Kevin, but I think he's listening.
That's accurate.
He can defend himself, all right.
Listen to this story that's in your Chicago Tribune today. It's Chicago marks first pediatric flu death as Arlington Heights Middle School sees high number of cases. And then going into Kate Thayer's story, at South Middle School in Arlington Heights, 185 students were out sick Wednesday, which is about 20% of the student body. School officials started noticing an increase in absences Monday. 10% of the students were out sick that day. That increased when 158 students were absent, and another 23 were sent home with flu-like symptoms throughout the day. So what's going on here? Because it's not just that school, but I think anecdotally, a lot of us know people who are suffering from the flu. Dr. Sunny Sharma is on a phone line and an internist with Amida Health. Dr. Sharma, thanks for holding, and thanks for joining us here on WGN. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So that's my pitch. Is it unusual what's going on right now, or welcome to February? It happens like this every year.
So it is something that's fairly common that happens every single year. It's just a matter of which point in time of the year that it does occur. For us, I think the way that our winter trend has been, how it's been so cold, people have been cooped up a lot more. They tend to be indoors surrounded by people that may be exposing them to the flu. So that's why we're seeing it at this point in time.
I thought that we were going to get out of it this year because I didn't hear a lot about this in December and January or November, you know, and February's over tomorrow. And I thought, wow, we dodged the flu season, and then we get this late wave. So the timing is interesting anyway.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And like I said, the weather being the way that it is, we actually had a wonderful winter all the way through December, and then January hit us pretty hard and led to all everyone kind of being in close quarters instead of being able to go out and not be as close to other individuals that may expose them. Also, the other thing that made this year so good initially was the flu vaccine is fairly effective this year. I believe the CDC reported that it's 47% effective, which compared to the previous year, I believe is closer to 20%.
If you've got a question or comment, jump in right now, 312-981-7200. So a friend of mine has or had the flu and is now kind of scratchy and limping back to work. Advise her or other people on when they are no longer contagious. When should they force themselves to go back to school or in some public setting?
So I think one of the first things is not trying to force yourself. Yes, there are going to be some lingering symptoms, and we call them post-viral symptoms. But the general rule of thumb is, once you're fever-free, wait 24 hours. And the important thing is don't be fever-free with Tylenol around the clock or Advil or other over-the-counter medications. You want to make sure that you do not have a fever for 24 hours without any medication suppressing your temperature.
Another friend of mine, actually this was my niece, I hope that my sister doesn't mind my mentioning this, but she had a fever the other day of about 106. 105 something, it was close to 106. And the physicians they were talking to didn't seem to be overly alarmed. They said, that's the body fighting the fight and, you know, get that fever down. But, I don't think they said that. I don't think they said get the fever down because getting the fever down doesn't reduce what the fever is representing. What's your comment about that scene?
So it is true that your body having a fever is your body's response in trying to fight things. And you do want it to have a little bit of a fever initially to try and lower things. Now, a temperature that is consistently as high as 105 or 106 for greater than a day or 2 days, that is something that you may want to go in and get checked again or take medicine to lower it down to at least a little bit more suitable level, such as 100 degrees or 99 degrees.
Yeah. And is this type of flu that we are seeing in the Chicago area right now a particular strain? Is it something that slipped through the vaccine crack this year?
So compared to previous years, the vaccine was fairly effective at 47%. It does not sound that high, but it is a pretty good percentage. But the thing that's very difficult is each year the strain of the flu vaccine does mutate. And with that, we are kind of chasing ourselves to try and make sure that we keep up with the vaccines. There are still going to be situations that slip through the cracks, but more important than anything else, it's making sure that people are vaccinated. More and more we're hearing things on the internet and people are reading about all these fears and myths out there about vaccines, and people don't get their children vaccinated or themselves. And it's not just at risk of that one individual, but it's the risk of everyone that they're around, their family, everyone they live with, everyone that they go to school with or they work with. So it's very important that we make sure that no matter what, we still get vaccinated.
Well, what if somebody in my family gets the flu? What are we all supposed to do?
So if someone in your family does get the flu and you were exposed to it, I do recommend contacting your own physician. There is an antiviral medication that is used for the flu that helps prevent it from coming into full effect if you've been exposed, or it helps reduce the symptoms and makes them a little bit more mild if you have them.
Tamiflu?
Yes, Tamiflu.
So take that. And keep going.
Yes, and so if you have been exposed, especially if it's someone that you live with, I do recommend contacting your physician so they could put you on what we call prophylactic dosing.
But I wonder how I live around that person so that I don't get exposed. That is, in my definition here, exposed means I'm going to get the flu. I don't want to get the flu, but we all live in the same house together. So should I not touch them or breathe around them? What are the rules of engagement?
So first and foremost, it's easy to forget about simple things such as good old-fashioned hand washing. Soap and water goes a long way, whether it's touching something that someone else touched or being in close contact with someone. Now, it's important for the person that does have the flu to try and cover their sneezes and their coughs with a tissue or coughing or sneezing into their elbow and not their hand. If they do cough into their hand, making sure they wash their hands. If there isn't soap and water present, using something like a hand sanitizer that's typically alcohol-based tends to kill a lot of germs also. Also, disinfecting other things that are commonly touched together, doorknobs, railings for staircases, the refrigerator handle, cabinets, so on and so forth.
Yeah, right, because I'm about to say germ, but that's different than a virus. But the flu is transferred from one person to another by physical contact, right?
It's actually more respiratory. They're respiratory droplets, but if someone coughs or sneezes onto a surface or onto their hand, it could be picked up by anyone that touches that surface afterwards.
Well, but now it's on my hand, but then I have to bring my hand to my eyes or nose or mouth or something, right?
Yes, and it's very simple things such as eating something that will provide that type of exposure once it's on your hands.
Yeah, how long does it live after I sneeze and there goes one of those little things? How long do they live out there in the environment before they just die a natural death?
So typically while they're out in the air, it usually only lasts a few hours, but it's typically recommended if it's been within 24 hours, you should be aggressive with the cleaning process.
Yeah. So do you mean, like, should we get wipes and wipe down all the handles around our house and stuff like that?
If there has been someone within the house that had the flu, I do typically recommend getting things such as those Lysol wipes or other forms of disinfectant wipes and using it to clean all the commonly touched surfaces.
But if I'm going to work every day, I don't have the flu, nobody in my family has the flu, I don't want to get the flu, I can't wipe down every doorknob I'm going to come into contact with in my life. What advice do you have to me as a healthy person, go to school and go to work?
As a healthy individual, you just have to do the best that you can to make conscious efforts of washing your hands and using hand sanitizer. If you go out and you touch doorknobs and go into even a restaurant, you should be making the effort to wash your hands before eating anything. If you do see someone that's sick around, maybe have a little bit more of a conscious effort to keep yourself clean and maybe go to the bathroom an additional time to use the soap and water.
What do you make of that Arlington Heights story, the incidents at that one school?
It's a very sad case. I was reading about it yesterday. One of the hardest things about such a young age is your immunity hasn't developed that it would as an adult. Also, you don't have the reserves that an adult has also. So when you are exposed to the flu, it could be a lot more detrimental and could even be fatal, like it was in this situation. That's why it's important for everyone that works in facilities with people in close numbers, such as healthcare facilities, schools, the entire staff, and all the children get vaccinated.
I guess that's why parents or, say, schools really need to have conservative policies about coming to school if your kid has a flu or coming back to school if your kid has a flu, right?
Yeah, I know it's very difficult trying to set up childcare, or people are reluctant to miss a day of school or a day of work, but you have to think about all the other people that you're exposing by going into work or school in that way.
Dr. Sunny,
so it is important to be aggressive.
Dr. Sunny Sharma is an internist at Amita Health. I've got a bunch of questions and comments from our listeners, both on the text line and on the phone line. Dr. Sunny Sharma with Amita Health Systems on a phone line. We're talking about the flu, which hit that Arlington Heights school. It's led to one death in the area and actually a few this year. And we're just doing some nuts and bolts advice for you and me. Doctor, this listener says, what about a mask for the infected person? Do you like that idea?
Though a mask will provide great protection if they cough or sneeze, there still could be exposure to other people around them. So I still recommend that they stay home if they do have flu-like symptoms, whether they're wearing a mask or not.
Somebody said the problem is the parents don't want to pay for daycare or keep their kid at home. They don't want to miss the day of work or pay for somebody to watch their kid at home, so they send the kids to school as though that's some sort of daycare for them. I don't know if you have a comment on that, but whatever your motivation is, sending a kid with the flu to school is it's just asking for trouble, isn't it?
It completely is. It, like I said, it's not just the child that's suffering at that point in time, not getting the appropriate treatment or rest, but it's all the other people they're exposing. I do agree it is very difficult for a lot of parents to set up things like child care, but many workforces out there, they not only provide sick time for you, but they'll also provide it for your child that is ill and if you have to be home to take care of them. So everyone should look at their corporate policy and see if that is an option for them.
Yeah, right. By the way, Lynn on line one says, does rubbing alcohol and peroxide combo clean? Do you have any suggestions about how to scrub things down, Doc?
So rubbing alcohol and peroxide, they do a great job of cleaning surfaces also. They clean, they tend to kill a lot of viruses out there, but be careful of using too much rubbing alcohol, especially if you're using it in surfaces around little children. It is still a form of very potent alcohol, which could be a could affect the children around.
Sonny Sharma is an internist at Amita Health. What a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving us some of your expertise today, Doctor. I'm sure you're busy, but you've been a help to us, and we'll call you again.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to being on and providing any other support that you guys need.
He's over at Amita. RoCon starts right now with Anna DeVlantis. Hi, guys.
Thank you very much. Anna off today. Actually, Anna's out sick today. You know, the flu was running through her home. I know that's a HIPAA violation, I think, of some sort. So,
what? You telling me that?
Yes. But we are, but what I'm, we're painting the water tower. Save Anna. We have a whole thing going on right now. And the kids are all crying at their lockers right now. But I know it's all going to be okay because we'll hold forth. Coming up on the program, I'm glad you asked. Michael Steele's going to be here. Also, Willie Wilson is going to join us. It turns out that Willie Wilson is the kingmaker.
I wonder, are you suggesting the role he played in the outcome of the mayoral election?
I'm suggesting that the role he will play in the outcome of the runoff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he represents 10% of that primary voter constituency that's pretty sticky to him. And where will that go? And that could mean the difference between Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle.
So what time is Willie coming on?
4:40, and I already spoke with him today.
Yeah,
and he has a very interesting way that he is going to decide who to throw his support
right,
behind.
So that's in play still.
He hasn't decided.
And I'm interested, Ro. I want to know what the terms are that he has for his support.
Oh, it's going to be interesting.
420?
440.
All right. 440.
Have a good show, Mr. Thank John. You very much. Appreciate it, John.